Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for lovers of the Hebrew Bible everywhere. I'm Dr. Tim McNinch. I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary.
And I'm Paul Esser. I am a PhD student in Hebrew Bible at Yale University.
And I'm Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren. I'm an assistant professor of biblical studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University. Happy Easter, everybody!
Yay!
We are coming to you today, a couple of weeks before Easter, but we are ready to see the bunnies. No, we are ready to see the eggs. No, we are ready to see the cross and all of the lilies in the churches. There we go. We are prepping the text for March 31st this year, an excellent day for Easter, not least because it's my birthday as well. And we are going to come to you today with Isaiah 25, verses 6 through 9. This is a party episode, and we are celebrating in absentia our dear colleague Rosie, who is in the final throes of giving birth to her dissertation. Not another child, but her dissertation, which is just as difficult. So keep at it, Rosie. We are on your side, and we love you.
Cheers, Rosie.
Well, let's get into it. So we're looking at Isaiah 25, 6 to 9, mm-hmm. which is a really nice little poem in the middle of the first part of Isaiah. Maybe we should give a little context, though.
Yeah, and we'll have to do dual context here, right? Like dueling context, dueling pianos. So, yeah. On the one hand, we got Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Assyrians? First Isaiah is coming to us from the 8th century BCE, and the Empire of Assyria is looming big on the horizon, threatening both the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, but especially the Northern Kingdom of Israel. This is when the stuff is about to hit the fan.
Yeah, yeah. And in that context, the prophet Isaiah is giving this series of oracles against the nations. Leading up kind of through chapter 23 in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. But then there's this three-chapter chunk, 24 to 27, which gets plopped in here and seems to have a different horizon. It's looking ahead to the future and also has a sense of the fall of the great city. Many scholars consider this to be probably more in alignment with second Isaiah, as far as its authorship goes. And so maybe just after the fall of Babylon and maybe connected with the return from exile to Jerusalem, there's a sense of the importance of Zion, of Jerusalem in this text. It very well could be that this has a sort of different, historical moment than the rest of the first Isaiah in which it's nestled.
Yep. It does remind me a little bit of the way sometimes with a lot of Hebrew Bible text, there's the story world, which usually is quite different from the historical context itself. And so there's this conflict between what the story is claiming and the timing and the dating that the story is claiming versus what actually is going on historically. So it's really good to point that out to preachers and readers out there so that you can take note of it, because sometimes they are clues that, you know, sort of give you a very confusing feel of what actually is going on historically in the text.
Yeah. And I think this is where, if you're doing like a Bible study on this to prep for Sunday and people are wondering about why isn't it written one at a time and clear chronology, this is where the metaphor of weaving can really come in helpful, of kind of God as weaver and weaving not only our lives, but even the word itself, so that you get these different textures and different colors that are placed side by side, not to be dissonant with one another, but in order to lift something up.
I think it does also say something about scribes and scribal culture and, you know, the skill of writing, right? Because it's like looking back and forth on ideas, which is like a beautiful way of thinking about the process of creating knowledge, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's no accident that these chapters landed in where they are in Isaiah in the version that
because,
you know, those oracles against the nations, which fit so well in their sort of 8th century context, are followed up in chapter 24 by this broad vision of the destruction of everything and everywhere and the earth and the heavens. And it's this more universalized oracle against everything and everyone, which is followed then by this vision of renewal that we pick up for the lectionary text.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think this is where it's helpful to think through this in terms of like eschatology, which, you know, if it's been a minute since you've been in seminary, of course, eschatology is talking about end times, but end times with a sense of always leaning towards salvation and God's salvific work in the world. So it's kind of that soteriology, eschatology. Mm-hmm. And we don't see that in the other 8th century prophets like Amos and Hosea, at least not with this sort of like developed and lyrical way of describing it. We see it certainly more in like apocalyptic texts or proto-apocalyptic, like Daniel and Ezekiel. Yeah. So this moment, this second Isaiah looking back into first Isaiah, is almost like an in-between stage in the development of eschatology in the Hebrew Bible.
I like that.
So, you know, use that in your sermon. I think it'll preach really well.
Every sermon should have 3 or 4 words that nobody knows, right? All right. So as the prophet is looking ahead to this vision of ultimate reality, what do they see? What do we want to talk about from the pericope itself? To throw out another word that nobody knows.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's something about this sort of grand feasting.
Yeah.
This mega heavenly or whatever party, right?
Yeah.
Where people are eating and drinking, and there's like a really good description of the kind of food that they're eating. A feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow. You know, like interesting depiction of people getting together and celebrating what I am imagining as this deliverance that finally we have, right? The conquest that we have through God, and we celebrate that through eating and drinking and making merry. It reminds me a lot of communion, but also intimacy and celebration and joy. And I like that it's part of the vision that the prophet is casting for the people, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like playing or walking a fine line between metaphor and image, right?
Yes.
Because we talk about how something is sweet, like, you know, oh, that was a sweet victory. And we don't mean it tasted good in my mouth, but we're using that image of tasting something. So I think this image is playing with both this imagined gala of victory and also just this the sensation of what salvation can feel like. And it will be so sweet and rich and et cetera.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think feasting is a really powerful image, especially in context. You know, we're biblical scholars. We can probably think of lots of examples in the Hebrew Bible where the plot of some great drama is initiated by famine, by the inaccessibility of food.
Yes.
And so that the signal or the metaphor that's used to talk about ultimate rest and security is a feast of rich food. There's something really profound there in that can be exciting to us. We think of it as a big party, but think of that in like a subsistence economy. Like the image of a feast of abundance is just a really powerful image.
Absolutely.
The other thing that strikes me in that image of feasting is that not only are these rich foods consumed, but also even death itself is consumed.
Yes.
Yes.
And a little Hebrew lesson here. Verse 7 says in the NRSV, he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that's cast over all peoples, the sheet that's spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The word destroy at the beginning of verse 7, he will destroy on this mountain, is also, it's the same word as swallow.
Yeah.
It's two swallows. Basically, as we're swallowing up this great food, God is participating in this feast with us. God consumes and swallows up all of the shame and disgrace and death itself. It's swallowed up.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Now, that's a feast.
That's a feast,
that's
right?
A feast.
That's amazing.
And I like that you pointed out that it's the same word, right? Bala. And it's both translations as like swallow, destroy in the first sentence and then swallow in the second sentence, is both in the PL, like exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Emphasizing the same process. I like that. But I also like the idea that the thing that is being swallowed first is the shroud. I think the NRSV says the shroud, then the sheet. And then the second one is death, like Tim Riley pointed out. I was thinking about like, what is this covering? What is this shroud on the people or the sheet over the people that is being talked about here? And it reminded me a lot about like mourning clothes and mourning garments. Yeah. Or like, I think one of the commentaries that I looked up yesterday said it usually traditionally referred to as the curtains that in the temple actually separates the holy, the place of most holy from public view, right? So what is being swallowed here is something that is related to death, but in this case is, you know, the garment of death, possibly, or the curtain in the temple that separated the public from the most holy place. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what has been swallowed here sounds to me like alienation and enmity, the thing that separates people from God or, you know.
When I think that sort of highlights as well that this is the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is over all nations. There is an expansiveness here that is unthinkable in earlier texts because it's really the focus is God and the relationship with the chosen people. And here in these post-exilic or exilic texts, we see that pivot outwards towards, yes, the chosen people for the sake of all nations, for the sake of the world. So
I did not do it, but it would be worthwhile to count up all of the alls.
In these
verses, because it's definitely a key word, the word kol in Hebrew, which pops up at least half a dozen or more times in these few verses. So it does, it has that outward expanding, universalizing sort of sense to it.
Yeah, I mean, I can see four between 27 and 28.
I counted five,
Five, right? Yeah.
Which is I hear six?
Going once, going twice. Well, and I think the place where this is happening really starts to lift up that distinction as well between God and God's chosen people and then God and the entire world, or the people for the sake of the entire world. I'm always struck by whenever a pericope starts on this mountain, and my question is, which mountain? And as a scholar or even anyone who's biblically astute, if we're talking Isaiah, we're talking this mountain, we're talking Mount Zion, we're talking the temple, the house of God. But it's always good to check your assumptions or just see if you're missing something. So I did a search on that word in Hebrew. It's har, which means mountain, and just thought, when does it else does it show up in Isaiah? What is the mountain doing? So it shows up a couple of times before this of significance. It's a general word, but when it's specifically talking about God's mountain or this holy mountain, it really shows up four other times before Isaiah 25 in chapter 2, 4, 11, and then right before this pericope in chapter 24. So in chapter 2, in days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains. And then it pictures all the people, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. And for out of Zion shall go forth instruction, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So again, already in chapter 2, we have that universalizing, all the people coming and then something of life going out. In chapter 4, interesting, there's an Exodus overtone. The Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. Indeed, over all the glory, there will be a canopy. So it's that like that distinctive God's presence, God's almost, you know, the closest thing we get to God's body in the Hebrew Bible is going to be on that mountain. And then one of my favorite texts in all of scriptures, Isaiah 11, verse 9, they will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain. Oh, I get emotional reading it. For earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord. You know, just that like, no, this is like, we overuse the term safe space. But here in Isaiah, it's like, nope, this one right here is a safe space. And then right before our pericope in chapter 24, it talks about God kind of punishing everyone, the host of heaven in heaven and on earth, the kings of the earth. Like basically this is like retribution that's been coming. Like all of the balance sheets will be accounted for. God's going to level the playing field. And after that, the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. So, and then it's immediately on this mountain. The Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines. So it's this presence that's there. It's this expanding capacity to house all the nations even. And there's things going out from it, and it is a safe space. And I just think on Easter in particular, like the context of this mountain is such a beautiful context to celebrate our Christian tradition.
I wonder what about mountains geographically that makes it, you know, really exciting for all these biblical writers to like paint these beautiful images with.
Yeah. It,
the connection here reminds me also of streams and rivers, right? It's this sort of soothing, cool, fertile space where great things happen. Great things like glory and fruitfulness, blessing and all of that.
And that connection to the created world too is, it's something that takes this somewhat abstract eschatological vision and gives it something concrete, right? Like this is, it's not just, you know, on a cloud somewhere in the ether, but it's on this mountain. The glory of the Lord is revealed, and the people are able to worship and celebrate the good things that God has done.
That's right.
I just want to ask what you make of verse 8, because that's got that really just potent image there. Ooh, the Lord will wipe away all the tears from all faces. The disgrace of his people he'll take away from the earth, for the Lord has spoken. That image, I don't know, it's one that's sort of been with me since my childhood. I don't know why that metaphor has been so important to me. Maybe it's because it's such a tender, sort of intimate image in the midst of all of this grand, like, victory and military metaphors and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And natural disasters and earthquakes and all that. And then you've got the Holy One wiping away tears from eyes.
I wrote here that it's like super hopeful and cheerful. It does remind me a little bit also of like Isaiah 40, which is like, you know, close to the second half, but there's this like comfort language
comfort,
over there.
Comfort people.
Which is super tender and soft. But, you know, the thought of disgrace being taken away is is so powerful. It's just like related to public reputation. Like memorial and a name, and how people perceive you as a nation, as a people. And the disgrace that is attached to your name is going to be taken away, right, by God. And perhaps a much better image is going to be bestowed upon you.
It's such a hope and promise. It reminds me of Gilgal when they first enter the promised land, and Joshua enacts the second or first, they disagree, circumcision of the entire generation. And then God says, "For today I have rolled away from you the disgrace of Egypt." It's like picturing a stone just being rolled aside, you know, and that's got tomb and Easter imagery for us as well. But yeah, I think the two of those together, and I think probably the text doesn't go here, but it makes me think of the shame of crying itself. Like how many people are, how many times do we apologize for crying, which is such a natural human, uncontrollable reaction to situations. And it's almost like, you know, wiping away the tears, but also the disgrace of having cried in the first place.
Well, let's do shift then to preaching angles or pitfalls or any sort of ways that we can resource preachers as they consider incorporating this passage into what they do on Easter Sunday.
I can go ahead and start out with the image of destroying death and swallowing up death, you know, which sort of came up.
Wait, that has something to do with Easter?
Not while I am drinking, Tim. Come on, man.
Yes, it probably does, Tim. I think that's such a classic Easter motif. And if we do look throughout the New Testament, whether it is the Gospels or Paul's epistles or even Revelation, there's this repeated motif of Jesus, you know, destroying death, right, in his work on the cross, and you know, in place of death, shares and generously gives everyone life, right? And I'm pretty sure preachers are kind of used to that. If you've been preaching for a couple of Easters by now, you're used to that. but especially the fact that it is in that swallowing up of death that we have this idea of new life and renewed relationship, both with God and then others of our neighbors around us, right? That's such a fantastic way of thinking about the gospel.
Yeah. So preaching both pitfall and angle, like we're on Easter, you got to talk about Jesus. We're in Isaiah, which knew nothing about Jesus. So how do you do these sermons without being essentially supersessionist? That's like, you know, this is what Isaiah was talking about. It's about Jesus. I do think I would caution preachers to be intentional about how you phrase your things. So if, you know, if you're talking about these images and then jumping to Jesus, having at least a little bit of a segue that talks about where they were in their original context, and then maybe how they came to be used or understood later. One of the images I've been playing with lately is of a stone being dropped in water. God took prophets and prophetic words and dropped them in a particular moment in history. And when you drop a stone in water, it produces ripples. And those ripples continue throughout time and into Jesus's time and even into our time now. So as I was thinking about preaching this, I was thinking about how these were the dearest hopes of God's people facing an impossible situation, whether it's the first Isaiah situation or even the second Isaiah situation. Mm-hmm. Hope is never central if things are fine, right? if things are fine, we don't really need hope. So the fact that hope is so centrally located in this text tells you that things were not fine. So these hopes may be dropped like stones into people's collective psyches and then produced these ripples into the ages and until a child was born and lived and then died and rose again. And people saw these hopes begin to take on new consequence, new term, new however you want to phrase that. So I think it could be, if you can phrase it like that, it'd be really interesting to honor that original hope and that later hope by interweaving the two texts together. And maybe towards the end of your sermon, picking different verses from each text and then reading them as if they're one text. And again, you got to be really careful because that can tip into supersessionism real fast.
Yeah.
But I, you know, just a little quick example, I played with starting with Isaiah and then interweaving John into it too, the gospel text for this week. So on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then Simon Peter came following and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there and the cloth that had been on Jesus's head. Then the other disciple who reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his peoples he will take away from the earth. Then the disciples returned to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb, weeping. So, you know, I think you could, and then you could go to like, you know, it will be said on this day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him. Jesus said to her, do not hold on to me because I've not yet ascended to my Father. I think you could really have fun playing with that.
Yeah.
And if you spend the time with the Isaiah text first, I think it will help people see the John text in maybe a new way.
I love what you were saying. Interweaving of these texts is really brilliant. And I love the way that you brought out the importance of hope in this, you know, you don't get tears wiped away if there are not tears, right? My sort of preaching angle is along those lines, thinking about this image of this future eschatological vision of things being all put right. It is drawn upon in Revelation. Like Revelation, I think it's 21, uses the same image of God wiping away tears and then the new Jerusalem, the holy mountain being there where God reigns. This is all like part of that vision, which we often shove off into the future, the someday out there. And yet this comes to us in the midst of all of the chaos and destruction and anxiety. Yeah. And I think there's something that's very relevant and preachable in seeing it that way, that the, in particular, thinking about Easter, the resurrection of Jesus, this hopeful eschatological moment happened in the middle of history, right? It happened while all of the chaos is still ongoing, right? But for us, that becomes this moment in history that's a sign, a beacon of God's good reign, even while we're wrestling against climate crisis and political chaos in this season and all of this other stuff, we can latch on to the reality of God's victory in Jesus that gives us a real hope to hold on to.
Yeah.
That's where I find some meaning, perhaps, in the way that this is nestled back in First Isaiah, you know, back in the midst of, in these chapters, this vision of, of worldwide destruction and chaos. We have this vision of God reigning on this mountain where death itself is swallowed up, and it becomes a relevant moment of hope, something to hold on to in the midst of the chaos. So I feel like, you know, most people hearing sermons this Easter Sunday will be living through some version of chaos.
My gosh.
And having a passage like this that doesn't hold out sort of pie in the sky type of hope, but a hope that is very cognizant of the chaos and the suffering and the tears, but gives hope nonetheless that God is in control and is reigning in a way that is beneficial to the whole world.
That's beautiful. I think you're right. And I think the fact that God is wiping the tears, like there's tender attention to the pain and suffering, not a dismissal.
Denial,
of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. No, I think it's a great point.
That's the hope that this holds out.
Yeah. It's like the resurrection life is baked with hope. It's an essential ingredient that you don't get the resurrection life without hope. Okay.
Seems like a great place to end our episode. Happy Easter, everyone.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
First Reading is produced by the three of us, along with the wonderful Rosie Candethal. You can find everything that you want to know about First Reading over at our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. You can also interact with us on all the social medias and also on YouTube, which is kind of new for us. So look us up on YouTube and you can find us there. In fact, you may be seeing this right now on YouTube, which would be really cool.
We're awesome. YouTubers.
Yep.
Email us at firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com. We hope that you all have a wonderful Easter celebration and that this conversation helps to give you something really great to work with for your sermon. Until next time, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Paul Essa.
And I'm Rachel Wren. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.